So, without further ado, this morning's session, first session, is kindly taped by Weber Training. So I'd like to thank Weber Training for that. And the first speaker that we have this morning is Sanjay Saint, who has been introduced already in this conference and has delivered two fantastic talks. So I would like to invite Sanjay to the stage, and please join me in welcoming him to the stage to talk about the technical and social socio-adaptive aspects of preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infections. Thank you.
Thank you, Brett. It really is a pleasure to be with all of you today, and I also want to thank Glenys Harrington for inviting me to Australia. But I will have to say that giving three talks to the same audience over 2 days is kind of intimidating, especially because I've used up most of my good stories. And it reminds me of one of my favorite quotes, which is, "I know what I have to do. The challenging part is making it interesting." So said Zsa Zsa Gabor's eighth husband on their wedding night. And for me, the most interesting person in the world is my wife of 21 years, Veronica, especially when it has to do with her shopping habits. But I'll return to that story at the end. So as Brett mentioned, I'll be talking about CAUTI, first the technical and then the socio-adaptive. We'll talk about normative pressure, and that's when I'll describe my wife's shopping habits in more detail, and then I'll end with some closing comments. So catheter-associated urinary tract infection is a leading cause of hospital-acquired infections. Depending on the definition used for CAUTI, it's either number one, number two, or number three. Largely due to urinary catheters, specifically Foley catheters. About 20% of inpatients are catheterized sometime during their stay. It can be for as brief a period as a few hours or for several days or weeks. And unfortunately, catheter-associated urinary tract infection leads to increased morbidity and increased healthcare costs, in large part because about a third of urinary catheters are unnecessary at any given point in time. About a third of the time, when a patient has an indwelling Foley catheter, there's no order for one from a physician, even though one is required. And finally, about a third of the time, when a physician is caring for a patient with an indwelling catheter and they are asked, "Does this patient have an indwelling catheter?" they would say no. So while infection is important, we also are curious about what patients think about having a latex tube thrust into their bladder. So we actually asked 100 U.S. veterans, people who served in the military and now are retired, what they think of having an indwelling catheter. And this is what they told us. 42% found the indwelling catheter to be uncomfortable. 48% stated that it was painful. 61% noted that it restricted their activities of daily living. And two patients provided the type of unsolicited comments that veterans of the military sometimes provide, and that is, it hurts a lot. We weren't that surprised by the discomfort or pain due to the indwelling catheter, but we were struck by the extent to which this commonly used device that's often forgotten tethers a patient to the bed, thereby increasing the risk of other types of hospital-acquired complications, such as venous thromboembolism or deconditioning or pressure sores. And in fact, with this in mind, a little over a decade ago, we wrote a paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine arguing that perhaps the indwelling urinary catheter is a one-point restraint. Strategically placed, preventing patients from getting up and about. And just like there's been a dramatic improvement in many countries in limiting the use of physical or four-point restraints, perhaps something similar can be done for the indwelling urinary catheter. Most infections are due to some type of microorganism, and microorganisms have life cycles, and Any good microbiologist or infectious disease doc knows you have to understand the life cycle, and you target that life cycle. It's true of urinary catheters. There's a life cycle of the urinary catheter, from insertion to maintenance to removal to reinsertion. And I think we need to disrupt that life cycle of the urinary catheter by going through these different steps of preventing unnecessary placement, and if it is necessary, making sure it's done using aseptic technique, maintaining situational awareness and properly caring of the catheters, prompting catheter removal where there's the most data supporting it, and then finally preventing catheter replacement using bladder ultrasound scanning. And I'll go through this in more detail in a moment. Because really the focus is on how we can implement changes to reduce catheter-associated urinary tract infection. And as I introduced this concept to you yesterday, implementation has a technical side. What are the practices? What's the evidence? What's the exact definitions? And a socio-adaptive side. What I'd like to now focus on is the technical. And the first is preventing unnecessary and improper placement of the Foley catheter. There are many recommendations put forward about what are the appropriate indications. This is what we tend to use in the United States. It comes from our CDC, the 2009 HCPCS guidelines, and it's based largely on expert opinion. But I think it's a good starting point when you undertake a CAUDI prevention initiative at your hospital. I think it's reasonable to modify this. If you have a physician who feels strongly that there should be an additional indication, or your clinicians think some should be removed. But I think this is where you should start. Most catheters are put in place either in the emergency department or the operating room. And the number one place is the emergency department. They're often inserted without clear indications, and they may remain in place for convenience, specifically nursing convenience, rather than medical necessity. What an infection control nurse told us was, quote, our other barrier is the emergency department, and this is where most Foleys are placed. Doctors forget to look under the sheets to say, oh yeah, there's a Foley there, and the nurses are not going to take the initiative. So if you want to tackle the issue of preventing unnecessary catheterization, you have to engage with the emergency department. But if a patient really, really needs a Foley because they have one of those indications, the next step is to ensure proper aseptic technique is used during insertion. There are many videos that are available. I just have two here from the New England Journal of Medicine that will help you and your staff learn about proper male as well as female urethral catheterization techniques. Remember, the goal is to avoid contamination of the sterile catheter during the insertion process. It's no different than when we put in a central venous catheter. And we should not assume that the healthcare workers inserting urinary catheters, whether they be a nursing aide, a registered nurse, a medical student, or a physician, actually know how to do this. When we've audited this process at our own place, we have found that between 20 and 50% of the time, proper aseptic technique was not being used. And we saw it among nurses, and we saw it among medical students, especially in the operating room. When I was a medical student, that's when I learned how to put in an indwelling catheter. And often you are taught by a surgical intern who may also not know proper technique. So I think this is a real opportunity for improvement. Once in place, we should maintain situational awareness and be mindful that a patient has a catheter. And that requires us to properly care for the catheter. And it's not just the nurses, but it's other people who come in contact with the patient, transport staff, patients in radiology, and other parts of the hospital. The key concepts are that we should keep the urinary system closed. In fact, probably the best intervention done was in the 1960s by Calvin Coonan, where he showed that closed drainage dramatically reduced the rate of bacteriuria compared to open drainage. So using a catheter that has a pre-sealed junction between the catheter itself and the drainage tubing will be very important. And we should make sure that the flow is unobstructed. While I cannot point to randomized controlled trials showing that if you kink a catheter or you make sure or that it's too full, that there's an increased risk of infection, but based on pathophysiologic principles, what we're trying to do is prevent reflux of urine that's been sitting in a drainage bag from going back into the bladder. The third is we should prompt catheter removal. In many hospitals, there are antibiotic stop orders or reminders if a patient's been on antibiotics for a certain number of days. The same thing can be very useful in reminding busy clinicians that their patient has an indwelling catheter. And in fact, this is a systems solution and a technical solution that has a lot of evidence supporting it. In fact, as of 2010, there were 14 studies that have evaluated urinary catheter reminders and stop orders, whether they be written reminders, computerized reminders, or nurse-initiated discontinuation protocols. And what they have found are that there's a significant reduction in catheter use by about 2.5 days, a significant reduction in infection by about 50%, and importantly, no evidence of harm. And the real harm here would be reinserting the catheter. So this simple approach addresses both the infectious as well as non-infectious harms of the indwelling catheter. And what we would say in the United States is that this should be a no-brainer. But unfortunately, it isn't. We've done several surveys of randomly selected hospitals in the United States asking what proportion of hospitals are actually using some type of a urinary catheter, reminder, or stop order. And what we have found that in 2005 it was only 9%, in 2009 it was only 20%, and we currently are doing another survey and we're hoping that this goes higher. I'd also like to point out we've done similar surveys in Thailand and in Japan, and with the support of Glennis Harrington and Kath Murphy and Mary Lou McClaws, we're going to be doing a survey also in Australia to see what your practices are to prevent cowdy and other types of healthcare-associated infections. But the issue is even though there's robust evidence supporting a urinary catheter reminder or stop order, why is it that only 1 in 5 U.S. hospitals are doing this? And in order to answer that question, I think we have to turn to the socioadaptive. Remember, the technical has to do with the practices and the evidence base behind it. The socioadaptive is understanding the culture of the hospital, the microculture of the unit, understanding the context, and also figuring out how to change behavior. And changing behavior is not easy in a hospital. In fact, Peter Drucker, the father of modern management studies in the United States, said, "The hospital is the most complex human organization ever devised." And we live this dream every day. So let me give you a 6-point plan if you would like to initiate a cowdy intervention at your unit or in your hospital. And the first is that you should form a cowdy prevention team that consists of various key people with one person identified as the team leader. One person does not constitute a team. And the key individuals on this team should be individuals from nursing. Because 80% of this problem, I would say, is in the realm of nursing practice as opposed to medical practice. Ideal if you also have a physician champion on the team, especially if you want to put forward a nurse-initiated discontinuation protocol. You need to have someone who's collecting data. That would be a good role for an infection control nurse. And ideally, you would have someone who could liaison with the senior executives. That could either be the project leader or it could be someone in quality management. The second is, once you have a team, is to develop a county policy for your institution or update the one that you already have. Third, pick a unit where to begin, usually where there's the most opportunity for improvement, because that's where the most catheters are, or it's because you are most likely to succeed there, as we discussed yesterday, in terms of anchoring bias. Fourth, anticipate barriers. In most of the hospitals where we have visited or tried this program, there are barriers, and the common ones will be nursing resistance. In some, there'll be physician resistance. And in a few, there's actually patient family requests for a catheter. At the end of my talk, I'll show you the website that we've developed through funding from the U.S. government that's free to use, that has detailed protocols and scripts of how to respond when a patient or family actually requests a catheter. And it's catheterout.org. Fifth, we should track performance, both process measures such as point prevalence of catheter use, and also looking to see what proportion of catheters are inappropriate. And secondly, outcomes, symptomatic UTI. If performance is not what we would like it to be, we should escalate it by doing things such as assessing and documenting the competency of people inserting the catheter, or doing focused reviews or mini root cause analyses every time there's a catheter-associated urinary tract infection. Much more time and resource intensive, but you would only do that usually if the rates are not going in the right direction. And finally, once you're successful, you spread to other places, other units in your hospital, or if you're part of a larger system, other hospitals in your system. And let me show you some of the results from our place when we've done something similar. And this is based on a systems redesign grant that was given to one of our public hospitals. It's a VA hospital. And I'm using this example rather than one of our private hospitals, since about my understanding is that about 70% of hospitals in Australia are public. And so this is the same type of issues you face as what we face in one of our VA hospitals. What we did is we tried to create a behavioral laboratory for interventions to improve quality of care and especially enhance nurse-doctor communication. One of our initiatives was a county prevention initiative focusing on a nurse-initiated reminder. And the key intervention was having the bedside nurse take ownership of the issue. And I would say this, if you're only going to do one thing in your unit, this is what you try to do. If the bedside nurse does not take ownership of this issue, it's going to be very challenging. And that's why an infection control nurse on his or her own, it's not going to work unless there's nursing buy-in at the front lines. And the way we did this is we have electronic medical record system, and we put in a new nursing template that allowed nurses to fill in, is a patient able to void without an intervention, in which case they'd go to the next screen. But if they need an indwelling catheter, they just tick off what's the appropriate indication, and we use the CDC recommended guidelines for that. If there is no appropriate indication, then there's a box to check, was the physician contacted? If the physician still thought the patient needed the catheter for some other reason, that just should be documented. But most of the time, when a physician is contacted, we would say, yeah, I agree, let's pull the Foley. And what we have found is that rates of inappropriate indications for Foleys went down from about 20 to 30%, where it was before this intervention, which is in line with what we've seen nationally, to less than 5%, and we've continued to follow every several months, and it's remained low. And county rates have gone down by about 40% as well. We've done something similar in the state of Michigan with about 70 hospitals. We've seen about a 25% reduction in urinary catheter use with a concomitant 25% reduction in counties. And we're now working with 850 hospitals across the United States, again, to have the key intervention be that a nurse assesses every day or every shift, does this patient still need the Foley? And the key thing that we did, and that what I'd like you to encourage trying to do, not only for Cowdy but other things, is to try to take advantage of the concept known as normative pressure, which is a fancy term for conformity. And in fact, conformity and social learning are universal. Throughout the world, there is this sense of wanting to conform, which is the tendency to prefer behavior that is common in the local population despite previous preferences for other options. Social learning is when the beliefs and behavior of a group are internalized by an individual. And in fact, some have said that this cultural transmission of behavior is a second inheritance system, which can be very powerful. Some examples are obvious. How people dress. These are the Maasai warriors in my home country of Kenya. Asian businessmen who prefer dark suits and light shirts. But it's not just humans that conform and socially learn. We see it in primates. In this fascinating experiment recently published in Science, the investigators followed 109 wild vervet monkeys. And they were put in four groups. One color of corn, which was pink, was treated to taste bitter in two of the groups. The other color, blue, was left untreated and naturally tasty. In the other two groups, the colors were reversed. Blue was bitter and pink was tasty. After 6 months, the researchers returned and provided the two colors of corn to the various groups again. This time, all the corn was tasty. And their focus was on infant monkeys and immigrant monkeys. This is an example of Dublin, who is an adult male vervet monkey. And you can see he's eating only the pink corn with juveniles of his group. The monkeys do not touch the distasteful blue corn. So let me show you the results. The key finding was that the preference for the tasty color was retained even when both colors were untreated and tasted the same. More interestingly, the infants who were never exposed to the bitter corn preferred the same color corn as their mothers. And males who migrated from a group where one color was preferred abandoned their previous preference and adopted the preference of the new group relatively quickly. The monkeys acquire this normative behavior through social learning. So now back to my wife and her shopping habits. And it has to do with normative pressure. So where I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan, there are two major grocery stores. The first is called Kroger. This is a large national supermarket chain. We say it's got discounted prices, which is a euphemism for meaning it's cheap. And there's no explicit focus on the environment. Whole Foods, on the other hand, is an upscale grocery store focusing on organic food. Upscale is a euphemism for expensive, and many people refer to Whole Foods as Whole Paycheck for that reason. The emphasis is on locally grown foods and sustainability and very much the environment. When my wife goes to Kroger, She thinks nothing of loading up the groceries in environmentally unfriendly plastic bags. It's what she does. But when she goes to Whole Foods, even if it is the exact same day, she always brings her reusable bags without fail. So the question is why? The same person in the same environment on the same day does something very different. And I would say it has to do with culture. The culture of the stores are very different. When asked why she does this, she told me, because if I do not bring my own bags into Whole Foods, I get dirty looks. So the culture at our hospital when it comes to Cowdy has now changed. Foley catheters go in and stay in for appropriate reasons. And we've hardwired the system because it's based on our electronic medical record. Bedside nurses track if a patient has a Foley and why every shift. Doctors are now frequently asked by the nurses, can we remove the catheter? And most of the time we say, sure. And when nurses keep Foleys in for their own convenience, they get dirty looks. So let me conclude with some final comments. Hopefully I've convinced you that Foley catheters lead to important infectious and non-infectious complications. Cowdy is a common patient safety problem, and I realize it's not as sexy as CLABSI or VAP. Many in the United States refer to UTI as the Rodney Dangerfield of healthcare-associated infections because it gets no respect. But we like studying it because it's actually a nice portal into how a hospital runs. It tells us how a hospital deals with nurse-physician communication and other endemic non-sexy problems such as falls, delirium, and pressure sores. Preventing Cowdy requires both the technical and the socio-adaptive, and I would actually say socio-adaptive outweighs the technical. Several practices appear to decrease Cowdy. Chief among these is early removal protocols. They should be prioritized. And I believe that normative pressure and culture change will help in sustaining whatever improvement you put in place. So thank you very much for inviting me to Australia. And I will leave you with our website, which, as I mentioned, has tools that you could use to engage physicians and nurses in your activities, a reference list of relevant articles, brochures, prevention protocols, and then also a table of common barriers and solutions for those barriers. Thank you again.
We probably have time for one quick question, if anyone has a question that they want to ask. Right, can you just be as loud as you can? I think there's a microphone there. If you can just introduce yourself. Thank you.
From the New Zealand Health Quality and Safety Commission. Just wondering how burdensome the data collection for your infection prevention and control nurses is within your hospital. You mentioned that they're part of the team for prevention. Do you have an electronic system for collecting the data so it's relatively efficient and effective?
Now, I'm glad you asked that question. Data collection has been viewed as quite burdensome. But what we've tried to do is figure out how to make it as seamless as possible. So we use numerators, so specifically the Cowdy definition that the CDC puts forward, and now we have to do it in all our ICUs. So that's a criteria that we use. The challenge has always been the denominator, because the CDC recommendation is to use per 1,000 catheter days, which is very challenging to get. So what we've done is a couple of things. Number one, we've actually recommended that for hospitals that are focused on quality improvement, the better denominator, in my opinion, is not per 1,000 catheter days. The reason for that is if you are very aggressive in not putting in the catheter, or removing the catheter very quickly, you will lower the denominator to such an extent that you may see this paradoxical increase in the Cowdy rate. So we actually recommend using 10,000 patient days, which can be obtained from administrative data. So it's much more straightforward. But then the final thing I'll say is that this nursing template that we put in place, where there's documentation of when the catheter was put in and when it was removed, that now allows us to calculate the catheter days pretty seamlessly. Right. So thanks for that.
Thank you. And please join me in thanking Sanjay again for his presentation.